March Madness is upon us. It all started with the traditional Selection Sunday when the 68-team field was revealed. Who made it? Who didn't? Who are the number one seeded teams? Who plays whom and where do they play? It begins with a pair of play-in games Tuesday and Wednesday before the action involving 64 schools begins Thursday, capped, of course, with the Final Four in the first week of April. The Sunday show featured analysis over analysis, intense questions over why some teams, like North Carolina, got in and some, such as West Virginia, did not. It's the same every year, but it's different because they're always talking about different schools. This year, the number one seeds are Auburn, Duke, Houston, and Florida, and no one really has a problem with that. It's all pretty exciting, and it's a wonderful time of the year in sports. Many of those who watch have their own group of people where you fill in your brackets and hope for the best. And by the way, the odds of picking all 63 games correctly are 1 in 9.2 quintillion. That seems tough to do, just saying. As the games begin, there will be buzzer beaters, shocking upsets, matchups involving great coaches who have great reputations. When the Final Four comes around after all the craziness, you will find that most of the teams still standing come from among the top four seeds in each region. Once upon a time, in a different life, there were 24 and 25 teams, not 68, in the tournament. The regions were named East, Southeast, Midwest, and West. Schools from those areas only played where they came from until the Final Four. Now they mix it up, and with so many in the field, you find St. John's playing the first two rounds in Providence in the West region. Go figure, a New York school playing in Providence, Rhode Island in the West region. If a conference, say the Atlantic Coast, had five teams represented, it was a big story. How about this year? The Southeastern Conference has 14. Many of them may have a losing record in conference play, but they have been dominant, playing teams from outside the conference, and that's where they will start when the ball gets rolling. I have no idea who will win, or make the Final Four, or even advance deep into the tournament. It's the old story. It's not the better team that wins, but who plays better that day. As a broadcaster, this was one of the thrilling and grueling weeks of the year. I would watch the Sunday show, learn the pairings, then wait for the call later that night to find out my assignment. Then the fun would begin. If I had a Thursday-Saturday region, I had to request plane reservations quickly, leaving on Tuesday. If I were assigned to a Friday-Sunday matchup, I had the luxury of an extra day to prepare and get things done. Monday and Tuesday before departure, I would do a deep dive into the 8 teams I would be covering. Remember, I would have to learn about some obscure schools where in those days, the information wasn't that easy to find. Wednesday and Thursday are the toughest days for any announcer covering the NCAA championship. My day would start at 9 a.m. and finish at 9 p.m. 8 schools would have practice sessions, followed by a news conference by the head coach. And then I would jump from the court to a back room at the arena to watch the players and then hear the coach, then return to the court when the next team took the floor. Preparation for these games were all about getting an understanding, in rapid fashion, not only who the players were and how they performed on the court, but human interest stories about them and the school in general as to their history in the sport. A lot to do in a short period of time. Practice was critical, not so much as learning how a team played, but who the players were. Put a number with a name. If they had names on the backs of their practice uniforms, so much the better. But many of the smaller and far less prominent schools did not. We always joke between us that we hope we didn't get a directional school, such as Southeast Louisiana or Northeast Missouri State, which often had no names on their uniforms. Now, don't get me wrong. We're not talking about grueling and frenzied work like the construction field or anything serious. This was fun stuff. Actually, I never called what I did work. Our crew would meet after the full day of action and coaches' interviews and go over each of the 4 games upcoming the next day. There would be no time available the next morning when the production crew would have to get to the arena early and do what they had to do. The next day was upon us, and we would broadcast four games starting around noon with a doubleheader. Following a break of about 2 hours, we'd be at it again with the final two games starting at 7 p.m. and ending around 11. So those 2 days, the practice sessions and head coach interviews and the four games of the first round, were the biggest challenges any of us faced. The next day was an abbreviated version of the first practice day. Now there were four teams left to cover, and coaches' interviews dealing with the upcoming second-round contests. The following day, the two second-round games were played. Now, week two of March Madness was not as furious to cover, with the four teams in the Sweet 16 and then Elite 8 round involved. So following a doubleheader on either Thursday or Friday, and a regional final on Saturday and Sunday, one of the final four entries would be established. Is this getting confusing? I've gone into detail on the prep for the first 2 weeks to indicate how much time and effort the broadcasters spend as you, the viewer, go back and forth using your remote to relax and enjoy the great action while sitting on your ottoman. Often my assignment for the second week would involve a totally different region, so it became necessary to learn four new teams from the first week of play. 1 year, I was teamed with the legendary analyst Billy Packer for the first round, while the lead play-by-play announcer, in other words, Packer's partner Jim Nance, handled the studio coverage, which he did so well. Then he would join Billy the second week, and I would be given a different partner. We were assigned a Thursday night game in Salt Lake City, Utah, then traveled by private plane to Baton Rouge, Louisiana the next morning for a doubleheader to be played Saturday, only to board another private flight to Minneapolis early on Sunday to broadcast two games that same day. How hectic do you think that was? Five games in 4 days in three cities, none close to the other. These experiences are what I remember more than the games I broadcast. I can hardly remember them all or most of them because there were so many and they become a blur. I even covered many tournament games involving Syracuse, my alma mater. Readers may wonder how difficult it was not to root for the Orange, or did I really become a big fan then? The answer is simple. There were so many facts to be aware of for both schools playing and the demand to concentrate intently on the action to make sure the calls were correct that it was really impossible to sit back and root for your school, even though I naturally wanted them to win. So, March Madness is here, and it's one big circus of competition involving drama, surprises, and wonderful stories of the people involved. It all winds up with a national championship for someone. The nets get cut down after the final game, and there are memories galore for so many. But for those who broadcast the games, the term March Madness couldn't be a better way to sum it up.